For the week of November 2nd, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 256, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in lovely Beacon, New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
What is in Beacon, New York?
Me!
Ah, okay.
And the estate of my friends. I'm having a Jacobian weekend here in upstate New York at the lovely restored 1700s home of my friends, the Christophers.
You know, I was actually in Boston over the summer, as many of you know, and I was just so surprised. You drive past all these houses that have the year they were built on the outside, and they're all in the 1700s, 1800s, and I just think to myself, imagine what the bathroom must be like.
And in Los Angeles, they have the month that it was built.
Yes, exactly. And it's usually in the future, so because they're already knocking down the one that was built this month.
Well, what's in the future for listeners to the show today?
Well, as you know, Michael, we cover all the entertainment news that's occurred over the past week. And on this week's show, we're going to give you a rundown on the top television networks in the United States based on total household viewership. And I'm sure, Michael, you will once again tell us how to fix the broken rating system. Personally, I say just cut the cord and get all of your television content over the internet. Unfortunately, the FCC might make it more expensive for consumers to do just that here in the U.S., as word surfaced last week that the government agency was leaning toward a grand compromise,
ooh.
And I use that word grand compromise.
Grand, how about stupid compromise?
Well, you know,
a screwed up idea that makes no one happy.
I did hear one person spell compromise, one pundit. They spelled it F-A-I-L. I don't know really what that meant, but in any case, this compromise would classify backbone providers as heavily regulated common carriers while leaving it open for ISPs to charge all of us a fortune. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Also known as the Chinese box office.
What?
Well, we look at box office around the world. Of course, not just North America grosses, but grosses all around the world. That lets us capture movies that are big hits in France and Germany and Spain and Japan, movies that we wouldn't necessarily talk as much about if we just looked at North America.
But what about Botswana? Do we cover Botswana?
I'm sure Botswana is covered somewhere in the grand worldwide totals, but we'd love to know all the markets. We'd love to see all the big local films, but we only cover the ones that break through in a big way, and more of that means opening in China, because China is a huge market. That's what Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles did this week. That's what The Maze Runner did last week. They both opened in China, and they're making a lot more money. Of course, they only take home 25% of it, but that's not that different from a lot of the rest of the world, is it, Sperling?
No, I mean, in some international territories, you're looking at 35, 40%. So getting 25%, you know, it's not great, but it's not nothing.
It's not dramatically lower than the others. It's a big difference, but they should all be closer to 50%, as I'm sure the studios would say. But Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles opened in China. It grossed $35 million. It's the number one movie around the world by a large margin. It's at $435 million worldwide. It's about to quadruple its budget. This is a big success. And of course, there will be a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. At number two around the world, The Maze Runner grossed $26 million. That's at $306 million worldwide. At number three, the movie Sperling saw this weekend, Gone Girl, another $24 million. That's at $280 million worldwide. It is almost certainly going to set North American and worldwide box office records for director David Fincher. Did you like it?
I did like it, actually. I understand. The funny thing is, you know, lights come up. And first off, it's a Saturday night, and I'm just shocked at how many people. The whole theater is sold out. This is a movie that's in its fifth week. Whole movie theater is sold out.
Well, but it's more of an adult film, a film that adults would want to go to. They're not going to be, no one's going to be rushing their first weekend, you know, fanboys. So it should have legs.
No, and I agree that, you know what, some of these movies, like Gone Girl and like Fury even, that are a little bit more themed toward an older crowd should be allowed to stick around a bit, because people like me can't always make it to the theater right away. If I don't see a press screening or an all-media screening, sometimes I'll have to wait 3-4 weeks before I see a movie like Gone Girl.
Well, and should be that they stick around if people go.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I guess you're right. Look at this. It was in the biggest theater, the biggest auditorium in this particular multiplex, so it's obviously doing quite well. And the lights come up and people are confused at the ending, and I thought, how are you confused? Did you not understand that? And this is where you interrupt me, because of course I'm about to, you know, have a whole bunch of spoilers, Michael.
Yeah, you're not going to give the spoilers away. I know that Oh. So you liked it. Do you think it's an Oscar contender?
It very well could be. For acting, possibly, and maybe even writing.
But not a Best Picture.
Because they basically nominate, you know, it's like the NBA playoffs or the hockey playoffs. Like, every team gets to participate.
Listen, I'm asking what's going to happen. I'm just saying, do you think it's worthy?
So far, maybe.
All right. So, yeah, in North America, the top grossing film was Ouija, a horror film. And it's, how many weekends has it been out? Two weekends. Yeah, this was a tight, tight race between it and Nightcrawler, a Jake Gyllenhaal film that had stood on the shelf for quite a while, and got quite good reviews. I know people who loved it a lot. Our friend Aaron liked it out in L.A. a lot. And Ouija just edged out Nightcrawler with $10.7 million, but Gone Girl made $8.8 million. That's here in North America. So you can see it's still doing quite well. It's near the top, and Halloween is a very depressed weekend for movie going because it fell on a Friday, Halloween, and that people don't go to the movies on Friday night when it's Halloween. So, Gone Girl was duking it out with the top films very close behind. But just below Gone Girl is Fury, another film you mentioned that's not for adults, but for anyone who likes good movies. It's $23 million worldwide. It's about to hit $100 million and counting. And then there's Ouija right below that at $16 million worldwide. It's topping North America, and it's in a few territories overseas. It's at $42 million, followed by another horror film, $15 million for Annabelle, followed by another horror film, $15 million for Dracula Untold.
I wonder why there are all these horror films out right now.
I don't know. At number eight is John Wick, the Keanu Reeves comeback film. Let's call it that. Why not? I don't know what the budget of the movie is, but it grossed $14 million worldwide, and it's at $35 million and counting. Number nine is The Book of Life, that animated film. That's at $14 million and $70 million worldwide. Then there's Jake Gyllenhaal. His movie, Nightcrawler, opened in North America, very good reviews, opened in three territories overseas, did decently. It's made $12 million so far in its opening weekend. A good, smart, odd film. He's really good in the lead role, from what I hear. Not quite sure why it stayed on the shelf for so long. But at number 11, right behind it, is one of our big international films. It's a Hong Kong action movie. It's called Kung Fu Jungle. It grossed $9.3 million. It's in seven territories. It stars Donnie Yen as a martial arts instructor who's been thrown into jail for accidentally killing somebody during our martial arts instruction. I don't know why.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah, he used to train cops. They threw him into jail because he accidentally killed someone. And now there's somebody stalking martial arts instructors, and the only man who can stop them is Donnie Yen. So he gets pulled out of prison with a chance to redeem himself.
Well, that's why I'm always pulled out of prison, to redeem myself through Kung Fu.
Through Kung Fu.
Yeah.
That's right. And there's a bunch of other movies overseas we've talked about before. Towards the bottom, we have Big Hero 6, which is opening up in North America, I think, this weekend.
Against Interstellar. Talk about a showdown.
Yes. Well, no, they're very different films. Big Hero 6 is a classic family film, animated. It should appeal to anybody. It's supposed to be getting pretty good reviews. It's now made $10 million overseas in one territory. So it got a jump start on its North American debut. And it will be facing off against Interstellar, which has finally been seen by a lot of people. And I'm hearing a lot of mixed things. I'm intrigued to see it, but a lot of people like two-thirds of it and hate the ending. Others love the ending but hate the first two-thirds. I don't know. It's, you know, a visual film. It needs to be seen on a big screen, and I'm sure people will go out to see it.
Will you see it on film or on digital? In IMAX or in a regular 35mm screening?
Well, it's shot in, and a lot of it is shot in IMAX.
True.
I don't know the actual running time breakdown yet. I don't know if we know that. We should by now. But yes, it's a film I'd like to see in 70mm at the Ziegfeld. That's a huge palace here in New York City. It's one of the last big places left. Who knows how much longer it will survive. And so I'd like to check it out on 70mm in that venue, because I loved any excuse to go to the Ziegfeld. But in North America, we had one other movie that opened, sort of. It's called Before I Go to Sleep. It's a British thriller. It bombed completely. Opened on 1,900 screens, and it grossed just $2 million. And it's the worst opening of all time for a wide release starring Nicole Kidman or Colin Firth.
Wow, I didn't even know this. I mean, I knew that the movie was eventually going to be released. I did not know this was the weekend that it was released.
Well, you know, it was 1,900 screens was probably being very hopeful. But what I liked was the Hollywood Reporter had a knee-jerk comment where they said that it grossed just $2 million, the worst opening for a wide release in their careers, not adjusting for inflation, they said. Well, like, no, adjusting for inflation is when you're worried that somebody in the past with a lower score might actually be higher. Like, if it opened today and is their worst, adjusting for inflation will only make it worser. So there's no need to adjust for inflation if you're trying to find something that grows less than this movie. But anyway, do you get my point?
What are you talking? Are we still talking about the entertainment industry?
Do you not understand? The Hollywood Reporter felt a knee-jerk reaction because everybody says now, oh, this budget, this grossing, not adjusted for inflation, not adjusted for inflation. They're all little Sperling Reichs. But this is open this week. There's no need to adjust. It's the lowest grossing ever. It's lower.
Oh, yeah.
Higher, of course, you need to make that point. But when it's lower than anything else ever, you don't need to worry about adjusting for inflation.
Okay, now you have me. You lost me, but now you put me back on track.
It's called math.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's probably why you lost me.
It's been a bad little time for Nicole Kidman. She hasn't had a real big movie in a little while, but she has a number of projects in the works. And guess what? Three of them. One, two. I thought there was a third. I get two of
them. This week in counting, Michael will tell us what comes after two.
This is what happens when I'm upstate. She has two new projects with Colin Firth, Paddington, the family film, and Genius, which is a pic about Colin, which is a pic about her and Colin Firth. He plays Max Perkins, the legendary editor at The New Yorker and literary editor. She plays the lover of Thomas Wolfe, played by Jude Law. That's a prestige project. She has a big film with Werner Herzog coming out about Gertrude Bell. It's a biopic about that fascinating woman who was involved in the Middle East in the early part of the 20th century. She's the female Lawrence of Arabia, really fascinating character. That's clear Oscar bait. So she's got a number of interesting movies and commercial fare that's coming out in the works. So we'll have to see how that all works out for her. And if you look at her projects, she really has not been trying to find big commercial properties. Paddington is the outlier there, as is The Golden Compass before that. You know, she's a woman who had her success and clearly is trying to make some interesting movies.
Well, you know, somebody who's had a lot of success and really has never looked to make commercial movies is Jean-Luc Godard.
Yes, we're taking to task Thompson on Hollywood, or I should say I am, because you don't want to be responsible for that, do you, Sperling?
Well, I don't know what you're I mean, I have no idea where you're headed with this. So.
Well, it's just a little article in there. It just caught my eye. They talked about how Godard's Goodbye to Language will not be playing, can't get booked in most cities around the country. And by most cities, we're talking just, you know, major cities like LA and Chicago. No one would expect a Godard film to open wide. That's not going to happen. But for the very first sentence, I was a little annoyed. The very first sentence says, despite the initial success of Jean-Luc Godard's 3D film, Goodbye to Language. Well, it's not a success. It's not a success at all. And they describe how the movie opened in two New York theaters and grossed $11,448.
Okay.
For a per screen average of $5,724. Well, that's not good. That's not people jamming the theaters to see a movie. That's an extremely low per screen average for an exclusive release in New York. I mean, that's what you'd expect from Godard, but that's not a big, you know, we just had a movie open to 100,000 per screen, you know, making it sound like people are clamoring to see this film and nobody will show it. It's just silly. And then they point out the reason, and you know why the reasons are. Godard plays in art houses, and Sperling, are art houses ready for 3D?
Many of them are not even ready for digital. So,
and that those are the last vestige of film. Now, we talked about how there will be no more wide releases in film. Interstellar undercut that a little bit, but it's basically true. But now what's happening in art houses? Are people making prints for art houses?
Oh, yeah. I mean, some, but mostly they are doing digital. So they're doing DCPs, digital cinema packages.
I thought you said they weren't ready for digital.
Like I said, they're not ready for it, but they're being forced to use it because, of course, getting a print is sometimes impossible.
But is it easier for art house films, for the smaller fare, for international movies that come to the U.S.? Is that a little bailiwick where film is making a stand, celluloid?
A little bit, but not really, because there's only one facility here in Los Angeles that can even handle it, which is FilmTech. Is it mm-hmm. FilmTech? Yes. So there's really no motion picture laboratories that handle 35mm film or film in general anymore.
Of course, we'd be talking about five prints, not 5,000.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so, I mean, it's not like you would need to have a big house that can handle stuff, but there's really nowhere to go to is what you're saying.
Correct.
So when they went digital, can't they automatically be ready for 3D too?
Yes,
I would have
and
thought
no.
Most digital projectors would be 3D compatible.
A lot of folks are buying, in the independent world, are buying used equipment, which means they're buying Series 1 projectors or they're buying projectors that are a little bit older.
Because they make very little money.
In which case, sometimes they aren't 3D ready, and or they don't have a deal with a 3D provider, whether it's Real D or Master Image or Dolby. They don't want to be responsible for the glasses. They don't want to have to give a percentage of the cutover. They're just, you know, they've just decided not to really get involved in the whole 3D world because there's one movie in a blue moon that comes along, like a Jean-Luc Godard movie, where it's worth playing it in 3D.
Right. We've had some of the best 3D films have been, of course, art house releases in that sense. That's a Pina Bausch film and yes. The Werner Herzog film Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Those were marvelous uses of 3D, which I'm not normally a big fan of. It just seems pointless. But, you know, there you go. So it's sort of interesting. But, yeah, they're just not equipped for it. They can't afford it. They don't got it. And frankly, they're not getting any movies made in 3D. You know, those are the real outliers. 99% of the art house films are not coming in 3D.
Yeah, I mean, there might be like three a year. So, you know, do you spend all of
if
your time
that.
Yeah, trying to support that kind of, you just don't spend a lot of time trying to support it.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, his film was in 3D. It can't be seen in 2D. You can't see it in your home. You know, you have to see it in 3D. So you're going to have a 3D equipped TV and glasses in your home. You cannot watch this movie in any format other than 3D. And so, yes, as cineast, of course, you want it to be shown in major cities. It's Godard, but you know, he hasn't had what was his last big release? Hail Mary, maybe in the 80s. Maybe that played a few art houses.
And
but,
I've
you know,
seen this movie. I saw it in Cannes. And I can tell you, okay, a couple things. One, there is no story. Okay, right. So don't look for one.
Yeah, this is not a movie that even the people who like it are like, I'm baffled, but it's important.
Yes, it's absolutely fascinating and yet completely confusing. And that's what's so good about it is that you're like the whole time.
You think it's one of the best movies of the year? Don't say it's so good. I mean, it's
no,
not that good. Is
no,
it?
No, no, right. no. But what's interesting about it to me is that there's no story. It diegetically is all over the place. The imagery is beautiful at times harsh. It's 3D and he crosses the axis so that your eyes start
yeah.
So that said, all of it as a whole is fascinating, and yet it's very hard to recommend because it is not for everybody. And it's
no Godard film ever is. It doesn't mean it's nobody wants a film that's recommended for everybody.
And I think it's really short too. I think it's like 60 or 70 minutes, and thank God for that.
I don't think it's that short, but whatever. I don't care that it's not for everybody, but like acting like you're shocked and surprised that this film is not getting shown in major cities, I suppose it's sad for cineasts, but for God's sakes, the technical demands of 3D mean most art houses aren't equipped, and it's Godard.
And it is 70 minutes long.
Okay, well, there you go.
And it does feature his dog once again.
And I was taking the task for their wording by saying it did better than these other films. And I wasn't sure if they meant those other films did on their opening weekend. I mean, this opened on a Wednesday. So 5,700 is not great by any stretch of the imagination for a film opening on two screens. And the other movies that they listed, almost all of them did better on their opening weekend, you know, on a per screen average basis. So everything about this article annoyed me, but it makes an interesting point that art houses are not equipped for 3D film.
Well, and if they are equipped, they're certainly not supporting it in full, the way, say, your local multiplex is.
That's right. And of course, Daniel Radcliffe's movie Horns, that opened up. It's based on a Joe Hill novel. Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King, I believe. But that's an odd little movie. Clearly not a movie that probably had big commercial prospects, but it opened up and it did very poorly.
Okay.
And the Hollywood Reporter said, but it was saved by video on demand because Horns was shown and available on video on demand for the past 4 weeks, where it made about $1 million. And they said, well, thank God for video on demand, because if it wasn't for that, this movie would have been a disaster.
So wait, it opened on video on demand before it opened in theaters?
Oh, it opened up it's been available on video on demand for 4 weeks.
Okay.
Now, and then it opened up in theaters on 100 screens, obviously not a lot, and it grossed $100,000, a very weak $1,000 per screen average. So this is another Weinstein Company, thing. They're crazy about video demand. They love it. So they said, look at that. We only made $100,000.
Have you noticed? I mean, part of the problem with video on demand right now is that the reporting on how much is made,
it's only when people want to tell you.
And it's usually inaccurate. And almost always, if you look at who is releasing the film or distributing the film, ironically, it's always the Weinstein Company.
Well, how do you know it's inaccurate?
Well, I know that from interviewing different heads of distribution at different studios.
You're saying that distributors are lying about the money that they're grossing on video on demand. Obviously, you're saying that they're over-reporting because they're releasing info to the press.
Yes, they will not say lying. They won't say that. They'll just say that there are inaccuracies in what is being reported. Remember, these are the heads of distribution.
As a journalist, why don't you write a story about that?
Well, why do you think
and say, you're lying.
Exactly how do I spell that? Is it with a Y or an I-E? No, I mean, that is why, obviously, I am interviewing these heads of distribution who are saying, yes, VOD is great for certain films.
Of course, by the way,
you know, the numbers that you're hearing, take them with a grain of salt. We can't basically call certain people bold-faced liars, but...
So there's no way to have an outside body like
NATO
or Rentrak or the Exhibitor Relay. Well, aren't they going based on what studios report to them? I mean, where are they getting their figures from? From NATO?
Well, in certain cases, Rentrak is getting them directly from the point of sale, and they are actually collecting the grosses for the studio.
Okay, is that where that's where everybody's pulling their data from, this point of sale information? That's where Box Office Mojo and Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, they're all pulling info directly from theaters, not from
actually
people who collate figures.
Rentrak is pulling it from the point of sale, the cash registers, the box office directly in most cases. They have systems in place to collect that data directly from the exhibitor and compile it and aggregate it for the studios. So they are a service provider. It just so happens that they're now also providing that information to others, like
us. I wonder why they're not banned from using that information, you know.
Well, I don't know.
So there's nobody doing that for video on demand, obviously.
No, there's no sound scan or something like that. The Variety's Hollywood Reporters and Box Office Mojos of the world are getting their information, their flash gross information, their overnights, if you will, from the studios themselves.
But that's not on video. They don't get overnights on video on demand.
No, not at all.
No, right? Nobody talks about that. You only hear about it if they want to tell you something that they consider good news. But here was my point. Thank you for that. That's fascinating. I can look forward to that story. But good God, what would theater owners say to the idea that video on demand saved this movie? Surely they'd say, well, if you hadn't had it on video on demand, maybe you would have made $1 million at the box office.
I think what they'd say is, well, you made a direct-to-video movie, and it did well on direct-to-video.
No, they didn't make a direct-to-video movie. Nobody makes a movie just to be shown on video on demand. Nobody. They might make some people in the old days used to make movies that were direct-to-VHS or direct-to-DVD. They had no intention of a theatrical release. But nobody says, let's create something for video on demand. It's a serious film with a name actor from a viable novel. The fact of how it's distributed does not quantify the quality of the movie. I mean, no. I mean, surely the point is that they would say, if you show it on video demand, people can watch it for weeks, and they can watch it with their friends for one low price, and then word of mouth gets out that it's not that good, and that, of course, will depress box office when it finally opens. And if you'd opened it cold in box office, you might have made more money. You might have made $2 million. Anyway, I just thought you would jump on that and know that that's what distributors would think. You seem to be very much in tune with how they think and their attitude towards the business.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's...
I mean, distributors, theatrical companies. I mean, what the hell? Chains.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes sense. So that they would... Yeah.
I mean, who knows what would have happened, but it got mixed reviews. And so saying you saved the box office by showing a video on D was an odd thing for, I thought, the Hollywood Reporter to say. Seemed to be taking, I don't know whose stance. Maybe that was the line that Weinstein's fed them. Ah, look how smart we were to put it on VOD.
Wait a second. That never happens. The Weinsteins never do that.
What happened for Fox? They had a good weekend, didn't they?
They did. They actually set an international box office record for Hollywood, $3.25 billion. And they set a personal best in North America with $1.5 billion. So they're basically making money, effectively.
Right. Plus, they've got four more movies to go. This is just for the year, and the year's not over yet. So they've already got the record for overseas grosses, and they've got their personal best for Hollywood in North America. And now they've got four more movies. They've got Penguins of Madagascar. They've got that Moses movie, Exodus, with Christian Bale. They've got a Night at the Museum sequel and a quickie horror flick. So those four movies, you look at them worldwide, that's another $1 billion. Though how quickly they'll make it and where, I don't know. But those movies will total up to $1 billion. So they're going to add a lot. How much they'll make through December 31st to pad this total, I don't know. But it's a great year for Fox.
Well, you know, it will be enough money for companies in other countries to go, you know, we think that Hollywood has, they're onto something over there.
That's maybe right, Alibaba. Alibaba was in town. Did you have a meeting?
We just missed each other. Our schedules didn't sync up, and Jack called me. He said his people would call my people, and we just had a hectic week.
What's his name? It's Jack.
Jack Ma.
Jack Ma, right. And in fact, it made news when he left town.
That's right.
People were like, oh my God, he left town. People wanted to meet him and they didn't get a chance. And they're like, no, nothing happened. They thought there was a crisis in China. What's going on? It's just apparently the translation of time frames and schedules got a little confused.
Yes. Well, and what I would say is, you know, when the president comes to Los Angeles, it really screws up traffic, including air traffic and traffic on the ground. Traffic is kind of messed up here in Los Angeles to begin with. You would think Jack Ma was the president. Everybody's like, make way, Jack Ma's coming, make way. Right. He's going to Sony, everybody out of the way.
When you've had the biggest IPO in history, you tend to get attention.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, so he's looking to talk to people. He wants a big chunk of Lionsgate. Now he's talking to Sony about co-financing movies. Everybody wanted a meeting just so they could say they had a meeting, right? Because if you didn't have a meeting, you looked like a schmuck.
That's right. It became kind of a pissing contest.
And he's like, enough meetings. I got to go work.
Yeah. Pleasure to meet you. Got to go.
Right. And another Chinese company is AMC. They're owned by China's Wanda, and they had a bad quarter. The AMC is, of course, is the theater chain here in North America. They said that, oddly, ticket prices are up, but revenue and ticket sales are down, and concession sales are down, even though the cost of concessions are up.
Well, and that's really the crux of the matter. There were fewer movies, fewer opportunities to go to those movies, and thus fewer opportunities to purchase concessions.
Right. So the amount you pay for concessions has increased per customer. So if you do buy concessions, you pay through the nose. Because as we know now, a lot of times you go to the movie, you're paying more for popcorn and soda than you are for the tickets.
Actually, this weekend, I paid exactly the same amount.
Oh, very well done.
For both the popcorn and a water as I did for the ticket. So it was like $14 for the ticket and about $13.
So much. $14 for popcorn and water. As bottled Dasani?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I hate Dasani. It's tasteless. It's the most tasteless thing. $14 is
ridiculous. It is water after all.
And it's $14. That is just ridiculous.
I agree.
They wonder why people sneak in food and drink.
Yeah. I brought in a hibachi. But
it makes you want to just stay home, doesn't it?
It does, actually. And when I do stay home, I'm gonna watch television, actually.
Ah, tell us.
Well, and you know, first, I think I might check out what's on CBS and then maybe head on over to NBC.
Ah, you're cheating. You're cheating. You're looking at a list. This is from our friends at TV Programming, TV Media Insights. I keep getting their name wrong because they changed it years ago, and yet it's still stuck in the old way. That's our friends over at TVMediaInsights.com. We've got a link to them in the show notes. They have a list of the top networks in total households, meaning which network are you watching overall? Number one, of course, is the network with the most hit shows, CBS.
Yes, 5.64 rating.
Number two, however, is a bit of a surprise. It's NBC with a 5.06. Oh, what one or two hits can do to turn you around. Thanks to football and The Voice and what's that show called? The Blacklist. They're doing on fire. They're doing all right. And then right below them is ABC and then Fox. That's what you would expect, right? Those are the big networks. They reach a big audience. They have big draw. They spend a lot of money on television. They're programming 3 hours a night, every night of the week, not to mention late night and in the morning and all that sort of stuff. Those are the big networks. But what's number five right below Fox? It's PBS.
Wait, what?
Right, exactly. When you look at a primetime grid of the top shows on television, they always list CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, and now more and more Univision, which is at number six, and the CW, which is listed way down at number 15. It doesn't even break a one in households, in total households. If you look at all the channels that draw more viewers than the CW, it's PBS, Univision, USA, ESPN, TNT, TBS, the Disney Channel, blah, 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 blah. Even the Fox News Channel and Nickelodeon reach more people than the CW, which, by the way, is having a great fall. They've got Jane the Virgin and The Flash. Both are big successes.
Plus, isn't that the channel that Supernatural is on? And that's a hit.
Well, that's Supernatural. Well, it's been a hit for a long, long time. It's almost at the end of its run. Yeah, no, they're having a good season. They launched two new shows, and they're both successes. So good to them. But my point is, you know, who thinks in terms of, you know, the major networks versus cable? It's just a silly, outdated way, I think, of looking at television.
How would you fix it?
Well, you know, this is the household ratings for an entire network, but we've been talking for a while about TV ratings and how they're not catching people like you. You say you want to cut the cord. right? You want to watch it on some other device. Other people set their DVR. They're going to wait 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days before they watch the show.
To be fair, I only said that because it made for good commentary at the head of the show.
Yeah, you're not cutting the cord.
I'm not cutting the cord.
That's right. And of course, we know that, you know, the rating system only captures, you know, overnight ratings and sometimes live plus 3 if you're really lucky. That's it. Even though people take a week or longer to watch a TV show. And so what advertisers pay for and the actual audience for a show like The Walking Dead isn't reflected in the ratings. We're told The Walking Dead this week was watched by 14 million people. But in fact, by the time next Sunday rolls around, 28 million people have watched The Walking Dead because they've watched it on video on demand. They've watched it on their DVR. They've watched it on an encore broadcast, what we call a rerun on AMC. They watch it that night when the second or third airing. They go over to a friend's house. They watch it on an iPad. They watch it on some other streaming device. You know, those are all things adding up, and we're losing all this attention. And it's sort of with the fact that all these networks have programming, with the fact that nobody cares whether the show is on FX or CBS or TNT, with the fact that people are watching things on DVR, I think there has to be a whole new approach to TV ratings.
Okay, and so how would you approach it? I mean, and I know you've said this in the past, but give us like a quick rundown of how you would approach this. And now, mind you, we don't necessarily have the technology to implement this.
Well, we can't capture all the viewing on other tablets, but there is a lot we can do right now. The networks and the advertisers clearly are sharing information about live plus 7. That means who watches a TV show live and then within the next 7 days on the capabilities available to them, like DVR, right?
Right.
We know they have that because they're paying for it. So they're clearly sharing that number.
Well, they're paying for live plus 3. They're trying to get to live plus 7, but go ahead.
Some pay for live plus 7.
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, it depends on the deal. But clearly they've got that info as the network is trying to show them, hey, look at all the people watching the show. They're going to share that information. It's not a secret to them. We just never hear about it.
So wait, let's start at the top here. So there would be no, for you, you've already said there'd be no distinction between network and cable. So
that's right. I mean, the CW is ranked 15th in total households for networks, and they only program shows 5 nights a week. Why are we ignoring ESPN? It just makes no sense to me.
And if I'm not mistaken, you want to do something which would be very controversial, which is have no distinction between daytime programming, nighttime programming, and late night programming. You just want them all just who watched what when, or who watched what?
Not even
period.
What? Who watched what? Yeah, exactly. I mean, if a Saturday afternoon football game on CBS is the 14th most watched show of the week, why should it get less attention than some 26 primetime shows that had a much smaller audience? You know, if 10 million people are watching that, why wouldn't that be on the list? Any reasonable person, you know, who cares if they go to the box office to see it on a Saturday afternoon with their kids or Friday night with the date? You know, it doesn't matter when you see a movie. It just matters that you saw it.
Because that's the way we've always done it.
Exactly. And that brings us to the next one.
Which is you don't want any distinction based on when a show airs, which is kind of the same thing, right?
I mean, not really, because when you look at a grid for prime time, which is what we're looking at now, what most people talk about when they talk about TV ratings, they're ignoring daytime and morning and late night. When you look at prime time, they say, well, this is Monday at 8. Here's what the five networks were showing. Here's Monday at 8:30. Here's Monday at 9. Who thinks that way? The Big Bang Theory just moved from Monday back to Thursday. I doubt my brother even knows.
I could not tell you when any television show was on. I could not.
It's very hard to remember. I can remember, you know, we're into it, so I know that Shondaland is on Thursday at 8, 9, and 10, and that How to Get Away with Murder is doing great. It's doing even better than Grey's Anatomy, you know, and better than Scandal. So I remember those things. But like, Utopia was just canceled by Fox. That was supposed to be on 2 nights a week. Then it moved to Fridays. And then MasterChef was going to lead off Friday. MasterChef Junior was going to lead off Friday into the new episode of Utopia. But since that was canceled, now they need something for Tuesdays. So MasterChef Junior has moved to Tuesdays. Again, my brother doesn't care because he's got that show set to record whenever it airs. He likes MasterChef Junior. Whenever it shows up on his DVR, he will watch it. So he doesn't care when it airs. So why? And we know there are lots of examples of 2 or 3 or 4 shows flourishing next to each other in one time slot, while another time slot, say Saturday night or Friday at 8, a lot of shows are doing poorly. So who cares when a show airs, since that's not how people consume television anymore?
So then if that's the case, there shouldn't really be any rush to offer ratings when...
Well, yes, right. But before we get to that, what I would say is if you want to list the best shows of Monday, just list the top 10 shows. Just list them. It doesn't matter whether they aired at 8 or 10. Just list the top 10 shows that aired that night. All right? One Duty for Resident Evil 10 and how many people watched them. You know, that to me is the way people watch TV. They watch The Good Wife. They don't care that it airs Sunday at 9.
Yes. Historically, the reason that's been the case is because you could either watch a show on CBS or a show on NBC at 8 o'clock. And so the head-to-head competition was an issue. That's not so much the case anymore.
No, and flow matters. It matters that Shonda Land is on Thursday at 8, 9, and 10, that you've got Grey's Anatomy, then Scandal, then How to Get Away with Murder. It's interesting and important for programmers to look at the different shows opposite each other and how they're doing and why, because people still watch television in numerous ways, and that's one of them, that they don't change the channel. Or you have shows that flow into each other, and that keeps them watching a block of TV. That's still valid to look at, but as far as people and the most popular shows of the night or the week, that's not how we think about TV. We can't even remember what night. And you used to know when a TV show aired to the second. Oh, you know, Tuesdays at 8 was Happy Days. I can still name it off, you know, and that's 60 Minutes was Sunday at 7.
Well,
you know?
And it's still Sunday at 7, so that's...
And it's still Sunday at 7, but kids today may only watch it online on CBS and only watch individual pieces that they want to watch, right?
That is correct.
Right, and when do they watch it? That gets us to our final point.
Okay, which is, since we're not actually worried about when things are airing, when the ratings are published shouldn't matter either.
Well, they should wait. It is ridiculous of them to rush out live, you know, overnight ratings and things like that when people are still watching a show. They're killing themselves by downplaying the audience that is watching their shows. They can't capture everybody watching TV in all those myriad different ways that we have now. Hopefully they can in the future when people stream it on their smartphone or their tablet or watching it down the street. You know, it's hard to capture all that, but they're not even telling us the story of what they are capturing as far as live plus 7. If a show airs on Sunday night, you have to wait at least a week before you can tell them how many people watched it. Otherwise, you're being a fool.
Yeah, but think about
it. There's no way to predict television viewing the way there is for box office. They've shown themselves to be way off time and again. Until they get better at it, we see some more settled viewing patterns and can figure out how people are watching shows and get genuinely accurate predictions based on early ratings, you can't extrapolate the way you can from a weekend box office.
Yeah, I would say that we live in a society now where people, they don't like to wait. And
you can't tell them the score who won a baseball game until the game is over.
Really?
You can't.
There's no possible
way to tell them who won the game until the game actually ends. You can't tell people how many people watched The Walking Dead until a week later. It's not possible because they're still watching it.
Well, tomorrow here in the United States, it's Election Day, and I can already tell you that the Democrats...
No, you can't. There will be runoffs. There will be two states,
well, the Democrats I watch the news, and the news says that the Democrats have lost the Senate, and they lost all these seats in the House.
And actually, if you look at the actual figures, a lot of states are too close to call, and there's probably the control of the Senate may well come down to two states that go into runoffs, Georgia and one other. I forget.
Colorado, maybe?
So you can't tell who won the Senate for weeks.
Right.
So I guess that's my whole point. You cannot have a headline tomorrow saying the Republicans took the Senate if there are two runoff elections that may decide the fate of the Senate.
Right.
And
now,
you've
put
got
yourself
one guy who's running as an independent who has to decide which party he's going to caucus with. Likely the Democrats if he wins. But again, you got to wait.
And put yourself in the shoes of a news editor who has tons of competition.
I'm in their shoes. And the responsible thing to do is you can't call an election until you know who's won the election.
I agree with you.
You look stupid if you call the election too early. That's the worst thing in the world you can do. Being cautious is always a smart thing to do. I'm not talking about being cautious and being caught wrong. I'm saying networks are losing the ability to tell people how many tens of millions of people are watching their shows. All these cable channels are pouring all this money into programming, and they're losing the chance to trumpet that fact. It makes no sense to me. I say give it to us all. And I would like a daily grid for the top 10 shows of Monday. And I don't care whether that's the Today Show or Judge Judy in the middle afternoon or Jay Leno, Jimmy Fallon, because he has some big guest on it, or it's NBC or CBS or Fox, or I don't care. Just list us the top 10 shows of the day. These Monday happened, and here are the 10 most popular shows. Same thing for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Give us a weekly countdown of the top 100 shows on TV. And if you're including morning, afternoon, and late night, 100 top shows is not too many. Right now, we do top 40. That's just because we cover prime time. And then I say promote the hell out of it. The whole point of this is to gain popularity and attention for TV. And all these channels with breakout shows like Archer might be a much bigger show if they were actually able to promote people watching it, if it made it into the top 10 for a night when a new season began, that would help them. If you added up the live plus seven, maybe Archer breaks into the top 10 for whatever night it airs, you know, during the summer or the off season, and that would get it more audience. I think it would be as radical as it was a change when Billboard went to actual sales. Instead of pretending they knew what people were buying and surveying record stores and then coming up with a fake list of stuff that they were just telling themselves what they wanted to hear, they started to actually list what albums were being sold, and lo and behold, country albums were debuting in the top 10. Gospel albums were debuting in the top 10. Rap albums were debuting in the top 10. And it changed people's entire perception and the reality of what albums were being bought. A lot more people bought Garth Brooks because they saw his album in the top 10. And it became a perpetuating thing. Look, this is a popular genre. People are actually listening to it. Oh, I should check this rap album out. You know, I think TV is losing a huge opportunity to promote itself.
Well, I would agree that if you could actually institute any of that, it would...
Well, you can institute all of it.
Well, if you instituted all of it, it would certainly be a big deal.
Okay.
All right. Yes, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Regal Cinemas is up for sale. Apparently, all you need to do is buy a movie ticket. Because, you know, what's the difference? You buy a movie ticket, it costs $1 trillion, or you buy the whole cinema, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Well, when the company had a slow quarter and failed to meet Wall Street projections, they placated everyone by offering, what, like a new business plan? A roadmap to the future? Innovative techniques to bring in moviegoers? No, they just offered to put the company up for sale. Success! The big problem was the summer's box office. Hollywood Studios did great. They released about 13 big blockbusters, and 9 or so of them are unquestionably hits. You can't do much better than that, of course, but Hollywood also released nearly twice as many movies the year before, in 2013, and a lot more movies meant a lot more ticket sales and more concessions. So more movies flopped, but theater chains were happy with all those bums in the seats. Now the only question is, how soon before Chinese Alibaba makes a bid to buy Regal? Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Big whoop, I guess. I mean, it's just bizarre as a business. Whoa, I know we're doing a bad job, so we'll sell it.
Yeah, well, exactly. Verizon wants to get into the content business. The communications giant is launching a website about the tech world called superstring.com. It hopes that it will compete with Wired and The Verge. It won't. Every story ends with, brought to you by Verizon! Exclamation point. And then in tiny type...
I think we added the exclamation point. Okay. That's why I put it outside the quotes.
Okay, well...
It's brought to you by Verizon.
In tiny type, after that though, it says, this article was written by an author contracted by Verizon, which kind of undermines the whole article, but that's another story entirely. Approving some companies, they just don't get it. Verizon's site is recruiting editors and reporters, but demanding they never do stories on U.S. government surveillance for national security, and never do stories on net neutrality. Of course, Verizon is desperately leading the fight against net neutrality in all its forms, and Verizon was the very first company exposed by the Edward Snowden leaks for handing over all its phone records to the U.S. government. The ban does not include discussing state spying around the world, so guess what? You can, in fact, write about China spying on its own people and a whole bunch of others. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it was a big deal, and it gained a lot of traction, and the New York Times came a-calling, and they said, oh, no, they fired the editor who sent out that recruiting letter, and they said, oh, we've learned from this, you know, going forward, we're going to, you know, we're very excited to learn from this. And like, oh, does that mean reporters can write about net neutrality and spot? No comment. You know, they don't want to, they're not saying they learned that they should have a free and open, you know, independent website that can have some sort of credibility. They learned they should not tell people about it.
Right. Well, and they weren't telling people about it, and people just kind of like slowly caught on to it. And then they slowly caught on to the fact that they couldn't, you know.
Well, the email link leaked that the editor sent around saying, look, you can't write about this stuff.
Exactly.
You know? If you want to come write for us, you just, yeah, that you shouldn't have put it in writing. That's what they would tell you.
Exactly.
And I actually wrongly wrote that Verizon was hiring editors and reporters. And of course, it's not Verizon. It's an outside company called Complex. They're handling this site. And I bet most of the writers who are writing for them won't even be full-time staffers anyway. They're not going to get pay and benefits because nobody likes employees.
That's true. In fact, to just ask Time Warner and HBO, they like to fire them. Okay, so now we have the story about Game of Thrones, which added 1 year to their 6-year deal over it. Well, at least the stars did. The people who are, you know, acting acting in the show Game of Thrones. They added one more season to their six-year deal. And what I would say to that is, does that ensure they won't be killed off in season six? Probably
not. It does not. It does not.
Yeah, well, there are several tiers of stars on the show, as you know, Michael. The top tier has negotiated together, kind of like Friends did, the most influential backroom deal of all time. When all those, I guess it was, what, four, six? I can't remember how many stars there were.
A lot of friends.
They got a lot of money too, and they got a lot of good publicity. Now, since they expect this show, Game of Thrones, to go about eight season, and the books might even get expanded to eight books, which would mean about nine or ten seasons, it's hard to understand why the deal only covers seven seasons. I think I know. Everybody dies. But the deals will all have clauses that say you don't get paid if your character dies, of course. They have contracted for people who might get killed off by George R.R. Martin, and nobody knows who's going to get killed off. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, of course they're going to stay on the show, but why just one more year? That's what I don't understand. They know they want to go at least eight seasons. Why they went through all of this just to take them to one? They already were signed for six, and then they push them to seven. But why not eight?
What they were trying to do is, we're going to do one more year, and there's 10 of you here negotiating with us right now. Well, next year there may only be five.
But they have a thing in their stuff that whatever you're agreed to will not go into effect. It does not guarantee work because they have a thing like,
No, I understand that, but it's hard to negotiate against 10 people as opposed to next year. There may only be five of you at this table.
Well, yeah.
So
I don't think there's any gain to waiting a year.
Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams were hoping for a slam dunk. Of course, then they realized they're not basketball players, but that's another story. They asked for a summary judgment in a case alleging their massive hit Blurred Lines was a ripoff of Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up. Mind you, they were asking for a summary judgment in a case they had filed preemptively against the Marvin Gaye estate and another company that claimed they had illegally sampled the funkadelic song Sexy Ways. The judge listened to a string of experts and musicologists and decided there was enough at issue to go to trial. Since the song increasingly looks like a once-in-a-lifetime smash hit for Thicke, settling out of court for big money seems increasingly unlikely. But then, no one likes to go to trial. In a deposition, Thicke said he was high on Vicodin when they entered the studio, and that Pharrell had the beat and wrote, quote, almost every single part of the song. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just the latest stage in a trial. These things tend to get settled out of court. All I know is that if Robin Thicke married Pharrell Williams, he would then be known as Robin Williams.
Ooh.
I just don't know why I thought of that.
Which is now legal in the state of California. Now, political protests continue to rise up in Egypt, and people continue to pay a high price. Sanaa Saif, the woman who was an editor and camera operator on the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Square, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for protesting a new law that says all protests must be approved in advance by security forces.
To which they would say no.
Yes, exactly. Amnesty International calls the new laws, quote-unquote, draconian. The director of the film spoke out against the ruling. Saif's brother was tossed into jail. He faces 15 years for protesting the protest laws. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, obviously. It's very sad to see. They're just trying to speak out. The director, by the way, was commenting to Hollywood Reporter about this from a film festival at Abu Dhabi. But he's Egyptian, so that, to me, is, you know, in a country with a lot of, right, that to me is not so outrageous. People may know my long, ongoing upsetness with people who treat Abu Dhabi like it's Las Vegas. But anyway,
and actually, the director is a woman, we should say.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Did I say man?
Yes.
I apologize.
Yes. She's
I'm sexist.
A well-known documentary.
I'm sexist.
Filmmaker. Jahan Nizam. Yeah. you're sexist. You heard it here first. Most people, let's face it, Michael, they haven't even seen a pair of Google glasses yet, much less worn the device in search of a killer app. But one thing is clear, don't put them on before heading into a movie theater. The MPAA and the National Association of Theater Owners, NATO, they jointly announced that Google Glass and other wearables with recording capability are not welcome at your local cinema. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
You can't record the movies? Is this news?
And exactly how are you going to enforce that? That's another story.
Because can they even tell always when it's a recordable glasses or whatever?
Well, they're pretty much all recordable. You know, here's the thing. You're not going to get people to enforce it. It's going to be very difficult to enforce.
I wonder if Taylor Swift wears Google glasses.
Well, you know, that's a good question. But we will know one thing, that sales tally for the debut of Taylor Swift's new pop album, 1989, will be announced later this week. Early figures show the album will blow past 1 million units, and it could be as high as 1.3 million units sold, and might even set an all-time record for a female artist, passing the 1.319 million units sold by Britney Spears. Who knows when that was? It looks like Swift's turn to pop will easily be the biggest album launch in more than a decade. And thanks to Adele delaying her album until 2015, there's no question Swift will have the record for 2014, Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, you know, album sales are so slow now that, you know, getting off a big thing like this is a huge, huge thing. So, you know, she changed from country to pop. That could have been seen as something dangerous and scary, you know, leaving your fan base behind, leaving the radio stations that had supported you. But she clearly left country in a lot of ways already. And, you know, I think country radio has been bizarrely forgiving of her. They're like, no, we love her. She's our kid. She's growing up. Hopefully she'll come back someday. But, you know, her album is selling a lot. Now the only question is how many album sales can she do? I mean, they need a hit. And her first single is at number 2. That's Shake It Off. She's got a new song, Welcome to New York. That's just debuted at number 48. And all her first four albums have sold between 5 and 8 million copies worldwide. So, I mean, it seems almost a given that 1989 will sell at least 5 million copies. And God knows the record industry needs it.
Well, there was a whole sketch on Saturday Night Live this week about how even if you don't like Taylor Swift, oh, the songs are just so catchy. She knows how to write a song.
Are you trying to imitate Chris Rock?
No, well, I think he was the guy playing it. That's very funny, though. No, I wasn't. But I guess
well,
maybe
you were.
Subliminally, I was. But her songs are so catchy. But, you know, here's the thing. This album had better have been a hit, because I was standing in line at the concession stand ready to give up like my kid's college tuition for a box of popcorn, okay? And there on the back of the soda machine was an ad for Taylor Swift. They hand me the popcorn bag. There's Taylor Swift on the popcorn bag. This thing was marketed to within an inch of its life. So it darn well better have done well. But, you know, she did say that if it didn't do well, it wouldn't be the end of the world. She would just shake it off.
Well, you know, the Britney Spears album was Oops, I Did It Again. It came out the day after my birthday in May of 2000. That's where she set the record for a female artist. And this will be the best-selling album probably since Eminem in 2002 of anybody, male, female, group, single, you name it.
Wow. It turns out maybe she does know how to write a song.
That's a touchy subject for a lot of people I know, but I won't weigh in on it.
Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this week these stories really do affect everybody listening. Well, okay, they affect the United States. However, we have seen what happens when the FCC starts proposing regulation.
What's that?
It's that other countries begin to look at it seriously.
Plus other countries have businesses that want to compete in the U.S., and if they have to pay more to get access to the internet in North America and customers here, that's going to affect them.
Correct.
The FCC basically has sort of leaked out or let people know what they're planning or thinking about in terms of coming up with a new regulatory approach to net neutrality. If you can very simply explain it, and then I'll ask you one question.
What I love is that, like, they keep the New York Times and all of these sources are saying, no, we have all these people close to the situation. Yeah, it's called the FCC. They wanted to leak this information out, take the temperature, see what people thought about it, and then, you know, see if it would stick.
And what is it? It's a hybrid solution, right? It's like, it's sort of a neither fish nor fowl solution to the vagaries of the internet and how to regulate it.
Yes.
Some people want them to declare the internet a utility, which would mean the government have a lot more control over how it's done. Other people want to say, open the doors. It's the Wild West. Let people do whatever they want.
And a judge recently said, hey, guess what, FCC? Because you labeled internet service providers information sources and not telecommunications companies, you actually have no right you have no sway over them. You can't regulate them in any way.
They regulated them out of the regulation business. So what did they propose? What are they considering? What is this hybrid approach to net neutrality?
Well, there's This new approach, and it's one of four potential ones, would actually bifurcate the internet and bifurcate the infrastructure of the internet into wholesale and retail transmissions, okay? And what we mean by that is edge providers, or the backbone of the internet, these big companies like a Level 3 or an XO.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Basically, the people that have built the infrastructure that allow the everything to go back and forth.
You mean like my internet provider? Is that an edge provider?
No, that is an ISP. So they are providing the internet to end users. That would be a retail provider. That would be a retail transmission. But all the people who support your ISPs. So these are people that you really shouldn't have. You really don't need to know. They're the companies that make the internet work behind the scenes. And they're also the people that are suggesting maybe we should, charge extra to the Googles, charge extra to the Netflixes, charge extra to all these different people. What's kind of happening is the ISPs are quickly becoming those companies or trying to.
You've completely lost me.
Well, an ISP.
An edge provider. Why are they using the word edge?
Because it's an industry term for bringing the internet to the internet service provider, bringing the internet to Comcast, or bringing the internet to Verizon, or to Time Warner Cable, or to Earthlink.
Aren't they the internet providers? Why do they have to have someone bring it to them?
They are what is known as a transit provider. They take information from a content provider. Such as
YouTube.
YouTube, the New York Times.
YouTube. Okay,
YouTube or Netflix. And they take that traffic and then deliver it to an internet service provider. That is an edge provider. That is somebody in the middle.
And who pays them?
And right now, it would be Netflix. They would be paying for traffic going out of their.
But I understood the intermediary companies hated the internet service providers and weren't demanding more money, that they were annoyed that the ISPs were trying to double dip. They're already getting paid to deliver content to the ISPs, and the ISPs, meaning Comcast and Time Warner Cable, are being paid to deliver it to me.
That's right.
But the content, those middlemen, Time Warner Cable, Comcast said, yeah, I know that Netflix and YouTube are paying these edge providers, these people. They have to build a lot of infrastructure. If their website takes off, they have to have a lot of back room, a lot of servers, a lot of support to make sure their website works properly. And they're paying those people. And yes, I know my customers are paying me. Michael Giltz is paying me for my internet service. But I want to get paid as well. I want Netflix to pay me too. I don't want them to just pay the edge providers. I want to get money too because they've got so much traffic.
Right.
Never mind that they're already paying for that traffic and supporting that with their own business and their own servers and providers and edge and all that stuff. I want them to pay me as well.
Right.
And when
Michael
look at it
is this
using
way.
A lot of content, I want him to pay me double.
Right. Look at it this way. You have a lot of flights coming in from Los Angeles to New York.
Uh-huh.
Why have a layover? Why not just fly direct? So effectively, what Comcast and Time Warner and all these internet service providers, the big ones at least, are saying to the Netflixes, to the YouTubes of the world is, you know what? Fly nonstop. Come directly to us. Why go through a middleman? Pay us what you would normally pay a middleman.
Well, but that would be fine if they weren't paying more.
They're not paying more. They're paying less. And it's kind of cutting the middleman out of the picture. And what the FCC is saying is, to make things fair for people who are trying to build businesses, maybe the next YouTube, maybe the next Netflix, maybe, you know, some new business, they want to make it so that the people who you would have to contract with, these edge providers, would not be allowed to play preferential treatment based on payments. So they would be regulated. However, the ISPs, the people we pay as customers, the end users.
Why aren't they edge providers?
They're not edge providers. They're internet service providers.
Right, but you're confusing the whole thing. It's not that they're just trying to take over business from someone else and saying, oh, that's a good business. When Netflix and YouTube explode in popularity, they have to hire someone and build up their servers and their back room and all that support in order to handle that flow of information over the internet. They got to be ready for when 5 million people log on and want to watch House of Cards.
That's right.
So they have to pay this company, this edge provider, and they say, oh, that's a good business. I'd like to be in that business too. But that's not what they're doing. They're not just trying to provide that service. They're saying, if you don't pay us, we're going to slow down your site until it sucks. And your customer, Michael Gillis, is going to be furious because he's not going to be able to watch House of Cards. So they're holding them hostage. They're not just saying, oh, that's a good idea. That's a good business. Let's get into that. They're saying, you have to pay us. And if you don't pay us, we're going to slow down your site until it's a trickle and it's destroyed as a business, which also means any new company that comes in, you better pay the highwayman a huge big fee or your site's never going
to
work.
Well, and that's what they're trying to regulate. They're trying to say, no, 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 you won't have to pay that huge big fee because what Netflix is paying is what you would pay. So that.
Well, then why is everybody angry at them? Why does everybody say this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard? Nobody seems to like it. The cable ISPs don't like it. The edge providers don't like it. Consumer advocates don't seem to like it. Why does everybody hate this?
Because it's not the way the internet works. Per the FCC, here's what an edge provider is. Any individual or entity that provides any content, any application, or any service over the internet, and any individual or entity that provides a device used for accessing any content, application, or service over the internet. That's what an edge provider is.
So we are edge providers.
Oh, but no, you're an end user. You are.
No, but as our podcast, we're edge providers.
Oh,
no?
Exactly. You just hit the nail on the head.
I go on Google or Facebook, I'm an edge provider. And if I use email, I may be an edge provider with a link embedded in it.
Correct. That is absolutely right. They are trying to make a distinction where a distinction should not be made, where it's impossible, in fact, to make a distinction. You're trying to label things that are too fluid, so it makes no sense. The problem the FCC has is that they're trying to kind of thread two needles here. One, they're trying to do something that allows for continued competition or the ability for continued resources and development to be put into technology on the one hand, so that the new Netflixes of the world are able to exist. And at the other hand, they're trying to allow the ISPs to be able to do like rate-based charges. So where if we go over a certain cap or if we want a certain speed, they want to leave that open. Also, the FCC already said that ISPs are an information service, not a telecommunications service, and that has gotten them into some trouble. They've already found that trying to reclassify ISPs, the people that we pay, Michael, as end users, that they can't reclassify. It's just too hard to reclassify that group.
It's not too hard. They're trying to pretend they're something they're not. They're trying to put them in a little box so they can say, well, this is how we'll treat you, even if it doesn't make any logical sense and has no grounding in regulation or the law or actual practice.
Yeah, it makes none of this. It's a real big fail, in my
opinion. Has the blowback been enough that this will not happen?
No. I think yes, because I think at least the Washington Post and others have said things like this will never stand muster. Once it goes to court, this will all fall apart. Because there's no way you're putting classifications onto something that changes too quickly. You're either an end user or you're a content provider, and you're both because you have a blog. And so how do you know, who's an edge provider? Now, there are, you know, kind of legal definitions and traditional definitions of what an edge provider is and what the backbone providers of the internet are. But if you're going to start to try and define them in this way, you will be wrong and it will cause problems.
There was a nice piece in the Washington Post. It was, I think, just online only. It was posted by one of their writers, David Post, but it was including an opinion piece written by Brett Frischman of Cardozo Law School. And he says basically the key to an open internet is non-discrimination.
Exactly.
And in particular, a prohibition on discrimination or prioritization based on the identity of the user or use. Meaning, no matter who you are, no matter what you're sending, you can't say, well, you're YouTube, you got a lot of video, we're going to charge you more. Oh, you're this guy, we're going to charge you less. You're that guy, we're going to charge you more. That shouldn't be allowed. If you're using it, you should pay what other people pay. This doesn't mean if, you know, you got a lot of traffic, you shouldn't pay a little bit more. It doesn't mean there aren't reasonable things as far as time of day and management of all the, you know, the bulk, you know, the huge, you know, bulging we have in prime time and different use. If you're using video, you're going to have to pay more than someone who's just sending text messages. Right. I mean, all those things are possible with that while still maintaining what we would call net neutrality.
Right. Or they could say, hey, look, Mr. Video Game Player, listen, you need a huge throughput. So you're going to have to pay a little bit more than grandma down the street who is posting to her knitting blog.
But isn't that what ISPs already want to do and people get angry about?
Right. And which is why the FCC, not wanting to go up against these ISPs like the Timecast, listen to me, Time Warner Cable and Comcast of the world, they don't want to go up against them. So they said, no, you guys aren't regulated at all. We're kind of leaving you alone. You can keep doing the very things that are kind of inevitable anyway.
And of course, the really frustrating thing is that we pay more than almost any other major country, and we have the worst internet service in the world. Well, it's not true, but we have a very low ranking internet service and we pay the most for it.
Yes, that is true.
Right. So, I mean, that's very frustrating. So if they say, oh, gosh, we want to charge more, well, God, you're already doing a terrible job.
Here's what I would like to point out. A couple things. There are these four different proposals, one of which we now have discussed, and that's the one that is kind of on the table right now that the FCC is leaning towards, okay?
Any of them good?
We don't know what some of the others are. But okay. What I will say is they're asking us to focus on this particular proposal rather than what the real issue is. And that is, there is no competition in internet service providers. And if there was, some of this might be taken away. Or if they made everything a utility, certainly there are problems with that as well. So, you know, one way to stem that right now that might make everybody happy is provide more competition.
So that means that you've got the public pipes, and then at the last little bit, different companies try to offer their services to you to have that right to go into your home, and then you've got four or five or six different companies offering that service. That's what happens in a lot of European countries, and therefore people get better service at a lower cost.
Yes, and nobody wants to talk about that because that's just a sticky wicket to begin with.
Well, but except that competition is the backbone of America. We love competition.
Well, no, what I mean is nobody wants to talk about that kind of public utility because it just...
Well, that's not a public utility. That's more competition. A public utility would be saying, you have a monopoly in this neighborhood. We can't work it out any other way. We're not going to adopt the European model. It's going to become like electricity and water. It's going to become a very boring, small company business that pays modest but dependable amounts, and you're not going to make a lot of money on it, but it's going to be dependable and safe and strong because... water and electricity and roads and internet are too fundamental to the operation of the country to allow it just to be handled by private companies with monopolies in each of these cities.
Well, isn't that kind of what happened to the telecommunications industry when they broke up Ma Bell? Didn't that happen with, they basically said now you can get MCI, AT&T, Sprint, you could get all of these different long distance providers and prices dropped.
Well, yeah, because long distance was paying for local. So now people probably, I don't know what the telephone bills are like compared to the 70s before the breakup of Ma Bell. There's a lot more going on with your phone now because you're getting a lot more stuff over phone lines, if that's the way to put it, as far as the internet's concerned. People don't have just phones anymore. They have smartphones. So it'd be interesting to know if overall prices fell, but long distance was subsidizing local. How it all played out, I don't know.
Well, if my phone is so darn smart, how come it can't solve this whole net neutrality thing?
and it's okay to use net neutrality, right? I mean, I know people say, it doesn't even reflect how the internet works. But we understand the concept and the philosophy behind net
neutrality. I will say this. When this story broke on Friday, we got a couple of emails asking whether we were going to cover the, quote, net neutrality issue.
Right, and that's how we all understand it.
Right. And just to kind of wrap this particular story up and wrap up Inside Baseball, one thing that struck me is that this is Tom Wheeler is the head of the FCC right now. He's a guy that used to be the head of the lobbying arm for wireless carriers and for cable providers. So basically ISPs and wireless providers. And what this would do would be to allow the cable providers, the ISPs, to continue to operate the way they always have. And it would kind of regulate these middlemen that the cable providers are trying to put out of business in the first place.
Right. It's the world as he, to put it in a positive way for him, it's just how he knows things work. Well, we've been doing it this way. Why change it?
Well, it's a way to say...
Or the negative way is he's a water boy for the cable industry.
Yeah, it's another way of saying, hey, guess what? In 2 years, I'm going to need a job. Okay? And remember what I'm doing for you now. And that's the problem with the FCC in general. But that said... this will be something that plays out, I'm sure, over the next year or two. I think this is kicking the can down the road if this thing actually goes through, but it will
because the courts will overturn it anyway.
Yes, and therefore the ISP, which the ISPs would love to have like 2 years worth of kind of obfuscation through court cases because it would just allow them to continue to set up systems that become entrenched in the industry.
Well, I know one person who doesn't care about this. That's LM Kit Carson.
Well, that's unfortunate because he passed away, isn't it?
That's right. He was a legendary figure in Hollywood. When I said he was dead, you said, what?
Yes.
You had no idea.
That's true. I've been preoccupied this week.
What springs to mind when you think of LM Kit Carson?
Probably Paris, Texas. Vim Vendors, Paris, Texas.
That's right. That's Paris, Texas. One of his best-known screenplays. It was a winner at Cannes. I think it won Best the Palme d'Or, didn't it?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, no. It was, or did it just win for screenplay? But it was a big film at Cannes, and certainly the high point of his screenwriting career. He adapted, technically, the script written by Sam Shepard. So he's not technically the screenwriter, but the adapter of a pre-existing screenplay, however that works. He also wrote the script for that remake of Godard's Breathless, starring Richard Gere, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. So clearly, he's not known as being a really big screenwriter.
I take it back. I take it back. It did win Paris, Texas won the Palme d'Or.
So he's not actually a major figure as a screenwriter, but he is a major figure in Hollywood. He was a reporter at Rolling Stone in the 60s and 70s. He championed Scorsese and De Palma. And he starred in perhaps the first mockumentary, 1967's David Holtzman's Diary. That was a really smart spoof of all these outsider artists who were starting to create really lengthy and obscure personal video journals that they would then show in 8-hour, slabs at the Anthology Film Archives and other places around the world. So that's a really key early film in cinema as far as documentaries and mockumentaries. And he supported a lot of people, perhaps most famously and recently, Wes Anderson and the Wilson brothers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, he really helped them and mentored them and helped get them over the hump with Bottle Rocket, which, of course, they were also mentored by James L. Brooks. But he was a really big player for them and a really big figure for them. They were even quoted, I think, in the Obit and the Times talking about Carson and how much he meant to them. So, he's been around for decades. He was a great figure. I think as his wife or girlfriend said, he never did anything for the money. He's just one of those people. They talked about him in college. He was a wanderer. He just went to Harvard, and then he went to here, and he went to there, and he took classes. It was a different era, wasn't it, Sperling?
It absolutely was. But what I can say, much like Jean-Luc Godard and L.M. Kit Carson, do you know who doesn't do things for the money?
Us?
Indeed, we don't. No, we give away our podcast every single week for free. Showbiz Sandbox is free. In fact, you can subscribe to it for free in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free or aggregate podcasts. That's where you can find us. And please do rate and review the show in those aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show, ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can head on over to Facebook and like us, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it seems to change a little bit. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Rachel, Monica, Phoebe, Joey, Chandler, and Ross.com.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
There were six friend. Cast members of Friends.
Oh, okay. You didn't let me finish the joke.
Oh, yeah. I missed your joke. I stepped in your joke. Success.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com or bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
And another thing about TV ratings.